Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Real spoilers powered by ReviewSTL.com.
Warning, the following film discussion will ruin the ending of any movie you haven't seen. Example, Bruce Willis is dead at the end of The Sixth Sense. See how I ruined it for you? Just like that. Here are a few more.
Silent breed is people!
I am the father.
Get it?
Real spoilers. You've been warned.
Broadcasting from the lush but not lavish studios located in the basement of the O'Keefe Institute for Advanced Film Snarkitude, this is Real Spoilers, episode 586, Da Five Bloods. I always feel like an idiot when I have to say, duh, five bloods. Like, when anytime they do that with a title, I'm like, I can't say that. I feel like such a poser when I say, I still call them salt and pepper.
You use the A-N-D, not just the N?
I use the and the salt and pepper.
You know, that is such an interesting thing, and I know we haven't introduced ourselves yet, but if you think about it, it gives such an impact to the film and a certain tone, and it works perfectly with everything that's going.
Hey, hold on. You keep going. I'll be right back. I got to yell at some kids.
Okay.
Well, let's go around the table, because we have a guest who's just sitting here nodding who can't talk. That feels rude. So we'll go around the virtual table. Hi, I'm Joe.
This is Kevin.
And this is Tom. And on the Skype-a-phone with us is Kalis Davis from Feel and Film. Hey, how you doing?
Good. Good morning to all of you.
Awesome. Thanks again for joining us. So what I was saying with the title was it's perfect for the film, but sometimes you feel weird saying it, and I guess it depends on who says it, but it almost feels like, I don't know if you would say cultural appropriation or like, you know, how do you say it? What inflection do you put on it? I don't know. Does this make any sense? Kalis, do you have an opinion on this? When I say Duh Five Bloods, does that sound weird or...
It doesn't sound weird at all. I mean, you guys hit it right on the nail. Duh, you know, that's been a lexicon in Black culture ever since I've been born. You know, there have been songs like The Butt. There is, like, you know, the duh. So when I saw The Five Bloods, I thought Spike was kind of like doing a reference to his 1988 film School Days, which had the song The Butt in it in a dance sequence. So I thought that was pretty cool. But yeah, I mean, y'all said it right, you know. It does feel kind of weird because you're used to seeing the,
yeah, sure,
and then the duh, you know, but it's just a part of Black culture. So,
and I feel like it's empowering too. Like, that's a positive and empowering thing to add to the film, right? And it's funny that you mentioned School Days, because it starts off in a similar fashion to this one, right? Where it's like the archival footage.
Mm-hmm. Like historical photos, you know, just like, yeah, really transplanting you right into the era.
Yeah, and it's definitely something that Spike Lee does, and I remember it in School Days. Not that that's the only other time he's done it, but yeah, a tool that he uses for sure, and it definitely serves this film starting off that way.
Shameless plugs, don't forget we're available on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, wherever you find your podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you never miss an episode. And of course, check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/realspoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group, just so you can be a part of the conversation. And of course, our Patreon, patreon.com/realspoilers, where for $5 a month you get all sorts of bonus content and the pride of helping out, and we like you just a little bit more. So anyway, there. Okay, now let's get into the film proper.
Well, maybe we could all start by saying where we landed on the film. I mean, first of all, I loved it. I thought it was great. But I was really surprised to see the audience reactions, like the low ratings and everything. I was trying to figure out why that would be. And maybe it's because Netflix doesn't usually put out a movie like this, or I don't know. This is Spike Lee's first Netflix exclusive film.
Well, wait, hold on. What do you mean that this isn't the type of film that Netflix would put out? Like, what do you mean by that?
Because Spike Lee is a hell of a filmmaker and an auteur,
mm-hmm.
and he doesn't make simple movies. So what I'm saying is
that
Netflix movies maybe are a little bit easier to digest, and maybe people saw a new Netflix movie and it's got Chadwick Boseman and Delroy Lindo and other big names, and of course Spike Lee. And then they watch it and they go, wow, this movie's really making me think. I was just trying to find an action movie and check out or something.
But
I don't know.
But if I think if the biggest name attached to the film is Spike Lee, and he's pretty much a
But Chadwick Boseman's Black Panther, okay, I mean, but, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but
Delroy Lindo.
But Spike Lee's got, you know, a 25-year head start yeah. on Chadwick Boseman, with all due respect. But I also think Spike Lee is a brand at this point. Like, and you if you walk into a Spike Lee film and you're surprised that there's a certain political content to the film, like, that's on you, you know?
Yeah, no, totally. And I'm not trying to say that, you know, anything against the film or whatever. My point is that on IMDb, this movie only has a 6.7 out of 10.
Which is just, that's insane to me.
And, you know, anyone can rate it from the audience.
Is it insane to you? I mean, when you, like, there's about 38% of the country that thinks this certain way, and there's about 38% of the people that apparently are giving this a bad review on IMDb.
Ah, you think for politics people are rating it poorly.
I will let you connect your own dots.
It's the same thing like when Get Out and Us came out, and people were just like bombing those with negative reviews, like racist people were coming in and bombing it with negative reviews because it had a black person on the poster.
Oh, that's a real shame, because honestly, I swear, I didn't even think about that. I was going straight to audience reviews, like they thought it was too deep or it wasn't what they were expecting. They wanted like a lighthearted action movie. But IMDb, out of 15,000 votes, had a 6.7. And the audience score on Rotten Tomatoes is 57.
That's insane.
So that makes no sense. But I think you hit the nail on the head. And it's very sad that people are rating this poorly or review bombing it because of the politics.
But here's the thing about this movie, though, is I don't really... Spike Lee obviously is a political filmmaker. That's just kind of what he is and what he does. But I didn't get like any political, there's definitely like parts of it, right? But it didn't feel like he was sending a message. He was making this movie about these men and their life and things that they've went through, but I didn't.
But that's political, Joe, because the whole thing is how poorly the black soldiers were treated during Vietnam. I think the reason why it doesn't seem as political is because most people think Vietnam was terrible.
Oh, maybe.
And we're talking about Vietnam, which is a war that people hated, and most people agree we shouldn't have been there.
But I will also say it's a war most people feel that way about in retrospect.
Yeah.
When, you know, right? Like when it was going on, that was not the take. I mean there's a reason people compare now to the late 60s, and it's because there were a lot of people that were like, no, we're at war, you support that, and you're going to see those lines drawn a lot of the same ways, not just racially but geographically. It was, you know, it was the rural areas that were like, we're going to send our sons to fight this war, and because that's what good Americans do, and like, you know, and so it's, yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a way you can talk about Vietnam and not talk about politics. And obviously there's a political message to the film. The, you know, arguably the main character of the film is a black Trump supporter.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you, you know, turn a blind eye to that?
So we talked at the top of the show about how it starts with that archival footage, and it starts with Muhammad Ali, who was very vocal against the Vietnam War.
Very much so.
And then they went to Martin Luther King Jr. And then they go to Trump. and it says President Fake Bone Spurs. That's how he's labeled on the video.
And they call him that in the movie.
Yeah. So now that you mention it, the bad reviews because of the political views. Yeah, I 100% agree. That's what happened. And so there are political views throughout this entire movie, and it'll be interesting to get into them as the podcast goes along. And of course, podcasting is an audio medium, is not a visual format, but Kles is a black man, and I'm interested to see how these things and events in the movies were interpreted by him and get his point of view. And I'm sure he took a lot of things that we missed, and I'm sure he'll be able to expound on different issues much better than we ever could.
For me, the first thing I took away is that Spike, he found a film that really shows the black experience of Vietnam. You know, he talked about films like Splatoon and Metal Jacket and Born on the 4th of July. And I'm not going to lie, those are great films. I mean, Born on the 4th of July is probably my favorite Oliver Stone film. But the one thing you didn't see is that you saw the black, you didn't see any black faces. You know, you saw mostly a lot of the white experience of Vietnam, you know, but if you look at the stats and the statistics, they tell you that over one third of the fighting force were black soldiers. And in the film, they talk about how they're being used as cannon fodder. Like they're on the front lines and they're being kind of sacrificed for a country that doesn't even respect them when they get back home. You know, there's even a section in the film where the Vietnamese radio DJ, she comes in and talks to the soldiers like, why are you fighting for a country that doesn't even respect you when you get back home? You can't even get rights there. You know, and it's the same thing that's happened in every war. Like, I know this is kind of going to feel random, but I have to tie this in. Like, has anybody seen HBO's Watchmen?
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Because you are I was thinking the entire time I was watching that DJ, I was thinking the exact same thing.
Because I think it's in the second or third episode, in the beginning, they show World War One. These black soldiers are marching through Germany, and these leaflets are flying from planes, and it's like Chancellor of Germany is talking to these black soldiers. He's like, go to a restaurant without being like kicked out. Like, can you enjoy the freedoms that everybody else enjoys in America? You know, you shouldn't be fighting us. You should be fighting your own country because they're your enemy. And I feel that Spike, he hit that right on the head when the soldiers are talking and they're talking about like, we gave everything to this country. You know, we built this country and yet we still don't get treated with respect. So in a manner, you get a sense of black empowerment. You know, these guys are, yes, they put their life on the line and they're clearly affected by Vietnam. But in the end, they see themselves as the Five Bloods, these five guys who have a lifelong bond. And I thought it was very, very beautiful. So I don't see how, yes, the politics are there. Of course, it's a Spike Lee film. But I think people are also missing out on the Five Bloods themselves, these five guys, and just how traumatized and how affected they have been by the war.
That's kind of what I felt. That's kind of what I meant, is like the story isn't, the politics, like you said, are there, but it feels like this is their story. These five men who were in the trenches together, you know, losing a friend in the heat of battle, like this is their story. And yes, it'd be ridiculous to say that Spike Lee doesn't have a political slant, but to me, this movie was mostly about these five guys coming back together to get what they deserve and what they fought for and what they, you know, trying to make their lives better. And that's a bone of contention when we get to that scene, what they're going to do with this score, right? Like the Chadwick Boseman character says, we need to give this back to our people. And I think they were all on that page in Vietnam, but as life progresses in the real world, and now I guess we're in 2020, like the movie jumps to 2020, or I have to believe that since they referenced that Trump is president. So,
yeah, and they're using cell phones and talking about email, and he's wearing a Trump hat. So, yeah, but I will say that like the age of the actor, the timeline I struggled with in this film because it was like the actors seemed too young to be Vietnam vets, but I also think, or at least be Vietnam vets of that era, but I haven't actually clocked their ages, so maybe I'm wrong, but I also think that that's kind of the game they're playing, and I mean, I don't mean that in a negative way, it sounds douchey when I say the game they're playing, but the narrative device of not using other actors or de-aging techniques during the flashbacks. And once I kind of like locked in on that's what they were doing, it was very preferable to either the substandard de-aging we got in The Irishman,
yeah,
or because the flashbacks they're important, but they're not as large a part of the film in terms of like timeline, like in terms of how much time you spend there. That like if they'd have used different actors every time they went back to Vietnam or the war, because they're always in Vietnam, I just spent the whole time trying to figure out who was who.
Well, so
and so
I'm just like I loved the technique that he used. Like the dropping it from the standard widescreen format, dropping it to a 4:3.
Yeah.
Just to give you that feel. I think I've never seen that. That's a brilliant.
Using film cameras that were actually used to document the Vietnam War during that era.
Yeah.
He had to fight Netflix to do that. They didn't want him to do it because it was going to be so much more expensive. He's actually filming on film. But yeah, he shot the current stuff on digital. And then the Vietnam era stuff, when he goes to the 4:3 aspect ratio, that's with the cameras from the time.
Oh, I just thought that was just a digital recreation of that look.
No, that's actually film.
Oh, cool.
That's brilliant. That's a brilliant move.
And I have to say, I loved the fact that they did not de-age them digitally or use prosthetics. Because think about The Irishman and how distracting it was the entire time you're trying to watch that film, right?
Takes you out of it.
Yeah.
It's so distracting. And in this movie, after you see it a couple times, you get what they're doing. 16:9 is current day. 4:3, Vietnam. You were never distracted. You never question it again. It's there and you're just connecting with the characters the entire movie. I'm so glad they didn't de-age them digitally. It was a brilliant move.
Yeah, and I think the use of the 4:3 aspect ratio was very, very timely because we have to remember that Vietnam was the first war that was televised.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
What was it called? The Living Room War?
Yeah, it was the Living Room War. You know, you could sit back and, you know, how small the TVs were back then, you know, with the black bars right there, but you were watching everything happen. And, you know, now we take that for granted now that anytime there is a conflict, we can see footage from that. But it wasn't like that for World War One or World War Two, and this is the first one that happened. And the de-aging, to be honest, I thought it was kind of weird that, you know, I saw it in current form. I turned to my girlfriend. I was like, wait a minute, is that them like now? But, you know, Spike was like, you know, come on, like, use your head. Like, you know that these guys were young during this time. But I also kind of felt like these guys were just reliving the flashbacks. And it's kind of like them old cells are just being transplanted.
Yes, exactly. It's their memories.
That's a great point. That's a great point.
Yes, it was their memories and stuff. And they were just reliving them. So I thought it was very beautiful.
I will say the only time I had an issue with the aspect ratio flipping in the different cameras was there's that middle part with on the boat where the guy tries to give him the chicken and you're getting some of it from the vantage point of one of their camcorders.
Oh, Eddie has like that old style handheld like,
it,
videotape camcorder. Yeah.
When it flipped to the camcorder footage, I was just like, I was really confused in that moment because I was like, is this a flashback? What is happening? Like it took me a minute to realize that kind of that image on the side was supposed to be camcorder. I think they should have put like a little, like, you know how you get that record thing in the upper left-hand corner?
Sure. I will say there was like a little weird, like yellow.
That's what I mean. That little yellow thing off to the side. Yeah. But I've never seen a camcorder do that. So, but I haven't used a lot of camcorders, but anyway, I just, that was the only moment where I like, especially because it was only used really in that one scene and it was pretty deep into the film to kind of flip the structure a little bit that I was like, what are we doing? But
So
honestly, my only complaint about this film is that I wonder if it would have worked better as a TV show because there's a lot of story packed in here.
Yeah.
And when you get the hints of the backstory of like of the guy who, you know, who has a father to child while he was in Vietnam, which was
that's
uncommon.
Otis. Yeah. Otis.
I just felt like, oh man, this has a very rich backstory that maybe would have benefitted from even more runtime.
Like a Band of Brothers type miniseries.
Totally.
Yes.
So let's talk about who the Five Bloods are. So in the current day, so you've got Paul, Melvin, Otis, Eddie, and then Paul's son, David, who is kind of like, he's like the new fifth member of the modern day Five Bloods. So they were actually named after the Temptations.
The Temptations,
that was a really cool touch. And then their squad leader in the flashbacks is named Norman, who was a producer for the Temptations. So kind of a cool little trivia nod there.
And Norman's played by Chadwick Boseman, who we don't know. Like when we get to present day, we know that he's gone, but we don't know what happened.
How?
Don't worry, yeah. We'll find out.
Well, we're gonna find out.
So yeah, so the whole movie opens with the remaining five Bloods coming back to Vietnam. And initially you just kind of think it's them just kind of getting back together in this country where they shared this bond. But as we move forward, we learn that back in the war, they were tasked with going after this downed plane that held I'm hesitant to say the word treasure, but that's basically what it is this. It's like a gold. Bars. It's this trunk full of gold bars. And rather they all decide, rather than saying we found it, they say we're going to bury it and we're going to come back and it's ours. Like, this is our money. We deserve this. It's for our people. And they all kind of go along with it.
This touches on what we were talking about earlier with how the black soldiers were treated. They call it reparations.
Yeah.
They're fighting for, it's their gold, and they actually label it reparations, which I thought was interesting. It's always interesting to see how people rationalize and justify their actions, and they make some very good arguments, especially Paul, who is... he's kind of taken on the role of leader, where Norman was their leader of the platoon, but Paul seems to be the leader of this operation, who's played by Delroy Lindo. And
how amazing is that dude?
I mean, yeah, he's fantastic in this movie.
He's never bad, though. Like, I've never seen a movie with him where I was like, he's kind of the weak point. That dude's always good.
He's always good, but he doesn't usually have this much to work with.
And that is true.
This is a fantastic script. Now, this was written by the same guy that wrote Black Klansman with Spike Lee. So, I mean, that was just a couple of years ago, and that movie was fantastic. So,
yep.
So they teamed back up for this one. Did you guys know, speaking of Oliver Stone, this was supposed to be an Oliver Stone movie before he passed on it, and it was supposed to follow around white soldiers. And so Spike Lee took this movie, and he turned it into what we see today and gave it the black storyline. And I think this movie is so much more powerful. I mean, I don't know what that one would have been. It might have been a fine treasure hunt type story, but this movie has so much more to say. And I think the fact that he applied this lens to it is a brilliant move. And I can't imagine any other way at this point.
Yeah, I mean, Spike, I mean, the way he's able to interwoven like historical footage throughout the film, has always been one of my favorite things about him as a filmmaker. Like, this guy just has a thousand out of everywhere. You know, I mean, go back to the opening where he has that little mini dance sequence of like the five guys going through this Vietnamese club and just dancing to Marvin Gaye. That was just such a beautiful scene.
Apocalypse Now.
Yes, it reminded me of the scene from Black Klansman where the leading character and his girl were dancing in the club, and you just see all these black faces just enjoying them. You know, I do think that Oliver Stone, yes, he could have made a great film because I mean he was a Vietnam War soldier, so I mean he knows about that world. But I don't think that we get this, like something that really like hits me hard, you know, because we've already seen what Oliver Stone can do with like Platoon and Born on the 4th of July. So it kind of would have felt like a retread. But for Spike, this is kind of like a new arena for him, because this movie also feels like more than a drama. It feels like an action adventure in some way.
Totally. I totally agree.
We get some action sequences in there and like, hey, they're strong. And, you know, my friends have been coming to me like, man, these action sequences are like lackluster and stuff. And I was like, yeah, but do you really come to Spike Lee for action scenes? Like, because I
know.
I mean,
this
I might go to James Cameron or somebody like that for that. But
no, this has a lot of action for Spike Lee. And this is his most expensive movie, budgeted between $35 and $45 million. So that's
yeah.
A lot.
So explain to me how this movie
that's insane.
Can look at
that's insane to me that Spike Lee is this deep into his career and $40 million is his highest budget ever.
But crazy, so huh? Here's the Spike with Spike Lee though. He doesn't he is kind of he needs that personal issue like that. He's that grounded filmmaker, right? He doesn't need a big budget. And you know who else doesn't need a big budget? Is Martin Scorsese.
Right.
If Spike Lee can make a movie that looks like this and looks as good as this, there's no reason. There's no reason that Scorsese needs $300 million for The Irishman.
He needs that million. He needs that.
You know what he needs? I could even agree with like $90 million for The Irishman.
I think we all can agree that that budget for that new movie at like $220 million is no, and that the new Walk Among the Flowers or whatever it's called,
Killers of the Flower Moon.
Okay, $220 million. You do not need that to make
no.
Yeah, and I've read the book, so I don't really understand like what he needs $200 million for, because the book is very very grounded itself.
Yeah, I mean it's he needs it to recreate the time period, I'm assuming, but. again, like it's not from a from what I would envision to be its visual aspect. It's not some grand sweeping epic. It takes place pretty much in poverty stricken Indian reservations, and it can't be that difficult to recreate, not $250 million worth.
It's got
to
be some kind of weird tax shelter at this point. Like, how on earth could you spend that much money on that movie? It's just...
No idea.
He's one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. I'm not doubting that, but that budget's ridiculous.
I'm just going to point... let me put on my conspiracy tinfoil hat. He didn't need these big, giant budgets until he started hanging out with the Wolf of Wall Street guy, and then all of a sudden...
See? Now that's what I'm talking about.
Got to his head.
Yeah. He's like, I can do what in the Cayman Islands?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they have this night out, and they're introduced their tour guide. And I think with Paul, there's an immediate... They don't really hide that Paul... I don't know if he doesn't want to be there or if he just doesn't want to be... He never got over what happened.
Yes.
And he does not want to be there to an extent.
I think you can say he's racist. I mean...
I felt that. That's kind of, you know, anytime he has an interaction with a Vietnamese person, even the guy who's their tour guide, he is having none of it.
The tour guy, he's actually pretty cool with, which was surprising to me when I went back and watched it a second time because I thought the same thing. But like when this kid comes up, he's like, get away from me. You could get the feeling he doesn't want to talk to any Vietnamese people. But when his tour guy comes, he's like, you know, we're cool. Hey, what's up? And
see,
you know,
I took the kid at the table as different but the movie never circles back around to address this, but like they would in Vietnam, a lot of times they would send kids in to talk to the soldiers,
yeah,
but then they would have a grenade on them and pull the pin. And so I didn't take that part as him not liking Vietnamese people as much as like it was really triggering him, is like, especially because the kid was missing a limb. And I think he was just like, it was really taking him back to that place of like, you can't even trust little kids in this country.
Yeah.
I could see that, but the way he treats the people on the boats and stuff, to me, I took it as him being against Vietnamese people. And I'm not saying he doesn't have good reason. He has PTSD. He was traumatized by the war. But to me, it was like he was very much not willing to give these people a chance. And, you know, the people sending drinks over, he doesn't want to salute them. I mean, but we're also kind of saying the same thing, I think. I mean, I agree the reasons are because of what you mentioned. I mean, he was in this terrible war where they were the enemy and he's got PTSD. So but you know, I think also he wears a MAGA hat and he's a Trump supporter, so
right,
it's hard not to say those things are because of racism, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's the statement they're trying to make.
But yeah,
with
I mean,
MAGA
I think
stuff too.
The Vietnamese people, like, they were very much his enemy. I mean, I'm still, you know, I'm old enough to remember like having grandparents that would like flip out when somebody bought a car that was made in Japan. Right.
Sure. Absolutely.
Because we fought a war against them, you know, and it's, you know, so I mean, there is certainly that mentality. I'm not
sure.
Not lobbying for it. For the record.
Right.
You're not for it.
Yeah.
So then we cut to Otis, who kind of breaks off from the group at this point, and even Paul kind of says, look, just let him go. He's got some stuff to take care of. And he goes to this beautiful house in Saigon. I guess it's like a business in Saigon. This woman comes to the door and it's immediately apparent that there is some chemistry there and there's some history there. So they sit down and they're having this discussion over dinner. And she is basically their middleman to get to Jean Renault, who's going to facilitate selling this gold for them.
Yeah, basically, if you have a chest full of gold bars, it is very hard to get that out of the country without any explanation.
Yeah, right.
Where did this come from? You know, what kind of illegal
pet peeve here about gold bars? Like, yeah. I feel like they never. This is all movies when they interact with gold bars.
Their weight.
They're the weight of them. They are so heavy.
Yes.
But
so,
you know,
so
what
heavy.
This movie does that's smart, though, is these aren't your typical gold bars, though. I like that they made them into those flat, rectangular little...
They're smaller,
Instead of the bricks,
right,
these are actually the little plates of gold. So
that,
for the weight thing, when they hold individual ones, is helpful, I think.
Yeah, but that still would probably be 15 or 20 pounds, and the way they're just waving it around, I'm like... That, I'm,
these
I'm
guys
like,
are jacked. It's Delroy Lindo. Come on.
They're also 75.
I could see... David would make sense. Like David is ripped to shreds.
Yeah, but so, Melvin, like,
he, you know,
that's a pet peeve. Like Tom said, that's an every movie with gold.
It's
sure.
every at least yeah. it's heavy when they have the backpacks on. They show a sense of weight.
Yeah,
right. So he sits down and they're having this conversation, and this girl walks. This is the moment that almost brought me to tears. This girl walks in, and it's very obvious that she's half black, half Vietnamese. And Otis has this moment where he's looking at her, and she doesn't really like. She kind of acknowledges him, and she leaves the room. And just the way Clark Peters plays this part, where there's almost no words,
he
can't find the words. He's welling up, and it's not like he knew. It's one of those situations where I think this was a common thing where. Women in Vietnam, there are probably a lot of mixed children and adults at this point from the war. And they just don't, you know, that's just kind of a thing.
If you know about Vietnam, the American soldiers frequented brothels.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there were a lot of biracial children born, and the soldiers would leave the country. I mean, if you've ever seen the movie or the play Miss Saigon, which is also a movie, that is what it's about. So this is a very common thing that happened.
You know, she was talking about how her child was being called like a cockroach, and like people would spit at them, you know. Yeah. So it, like, people don't understand, like, racism. Two different sides of ethnicity. So, you know, either you're not good to one side or you're just not black enough for the other side. And, you know, I love that Spike, you know, he really did a great job of humanizing these Vietnamese people, you know, because most of the time in these Vietnam War films, all we see are the Vietnamese people just being soldiers and just killing people and torturing them and all that. But these ones, he's showing that, like, hey, this Vietnam War didn't just Americans, it affected the Vietnamese people as well. You know, not everybody was down with this war as well. It broke up families, like what she said, like it broke up a lot of families. Like, you know, a lot of people ended up being hurt. A lot of people are suffering the same PTSD that Paul is even facing, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think also it's interesting to see because Americans, or white Americans, when they think about racism, they think about it in pretty simplistic terms typically, and they typically think of racism in terms of black and white, right?
Sure.
And there's all bunches of ways to be racist. So let's not limit ourselves, shall we? But this kind of shines a light on that it's like, here's a situation where, you know, where white's removed from the equation. And there's still racism. Like I said, there's a lot of different angles to come at that from.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I just think the way that he plays this scene where he's not a bad guy, right? He didn't do this, and he knew that child was there, and he just bolted. He didn't know,
right?
And you know, it's 1970, whatever. There's no way to reach out to him in the United States. Says, hey, by the way, you have a daughter here. So there's just this moment where he feels awful that his daughter has had to live this life. But also, like, I have a daughter, like I have this child here that I don't know. And I think it's such a powerful scene, at least for me. It was.
I looked up the numbers here, and according to AmerAsians Without Borders, they actually, if you go see the play Miss Saigon, they actually show this really touching footage, and they show real children that were born from the GIs when they would visit during the war. And they estimate between 25,000 and 30,000 children.
My goodness.
Born in the 10 years during the Vietnam War. So that is a lot of children that were left behind.
Yeah. And like I said, he doesn't give off the vibes.
Still haven't been able to get in touch with their real fathers, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is like, we're getting to a point now where they won't, you know, like these veterans. And even when we get to the end and we find out what's wrong with Paul, a lot of these veterans have the same issues, and not just the mental issues. I mean, the physical stuff of things they were exposed to, over in Vietnam, whether it's Agent Orange or whatever, it was over there. So we're getting to a point now in 2020 where those veterans are going to be dying off. You know, I mean, how many World War II vets are even still alive at this point? A handful, maybe a little bit more. You know,
it's very sad, but yeah, for this character, it's really touching that, I mean, in that moment he discovered, like you said, Joe, he didn't know. And so there's this child that he couldn't help, didn't even know existed.
Right.
And so it wasn't like a malicious thing, but here now he finds out, and I agree, a great performance as he's discovering this.
Where has this guy been?
Oh, he was in my favorite TV show of all time is The Wire, and Clark Peters, he plays a character there named Lester Freeman. So great in that show. So that's where I knew him from. I pointed to my girlfriend, yo, that's Lester Freeman.
that's a testament to Spike Lee, right? Like, Spike Lee has an eye for talent that you may not know, and getting to showcase, like, Delroy is just one of those dudes who you know him. You recognize him. There was that clip of him. I assume it's from a TV show where he's on like a news show and he's calling the white guy out because he can't say a certain word. Like, that's the clip that's been going around recently. And I don't think that's a real news thing. That must be from a show. It would be amazing if that was a real thing, just to watch him tear that dude apart. But he's always been one of those actors that you recognize him. You recognize the guy that plays Melvin. He's another one of those. I feel like I've seen him more in comedies, but
Isaiah Whitlock Jr.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was also in The Wire as well.
Yeah. Those two were in the, yeah.
Yeah. He was the corrupt senator guy.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yes. with his famous phrase, she, you know.
And there's even one of those, he even says
he
it in this
he does it in
movie.
This, doesn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah.
So it's just, he had, and the guy, and David, I think, was phenomenal.
Yeah, Jonathan Majors.
Was amazing. Like, mm-hmm. You know, you think when you're first introduced to David, who is, he kind of shows up, he's the son of Paul, Delroy Lindo. He shows up in the hotel room. And you kind of think that he's scamming the whole thing. Like, that's the interpretation from that first scene.
Right. He shows up, give me one fifth of the gold kind of thing.
Right. And Paul's like, no, go F yourself. What are you doing here? Why are you here?
He's basically like, well, if you want any of this money, you're going to get cut me in. So, I mean, he does pretty much blackmail him into it, but his reasons aren't, it's not as bad as you would think up front. But real quick, I have to say, have you seen The Last Black Man in San Francisco?
No.
Oh, top 10 for me last year.
Yeah, it's an amazing film. It's so good. That's what this guy was just in, Jonathan Majors.
Okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, he's the lead in that. And I mean, that movie is so good. You got to see this.
And those are the three guys that you basically focus on for this movie is Paul, David, and Otis. Chadwick Boseman is barely in this movie, but that's they plan it that way. Like, it's not like they're,
yeah,
you know, he's a side character that
they got him for a cup of coffee. He's a great actor. He filmed a few of the flashbacks. I mean, that's the thing, is we know he died. We don't know how until we get into the movie. But after they find the gold, they end up getting into a skirmish with the Viet Cong, and he ends up dying. And I guess, should we just spoil now how he dies? Since that is the show?
Sure.
Friendly fire.
There was a Viet Cong soldier that came in from the side of like this airplane, and Paul reacts and fires wildly into the same area and accidentally hits Norman in the gut and kills
him. So I think that says a lot. When you go back and watch the movie the second time through these new eyes, you see maybe why Paul is a little more messed up, right? The war was hard, and it affected everyone, but he killed his platoon leader, like their friend, and I mean, he has
their idol. It was more than a friend, it was their idol, because I mean, he was teaching them things that they had never heard of, and
right.
I think it's,
right.
I love the fact that, like, if that character had made it home, he probably would have literally been a Black Panther.
I mean, you're not wrong. You're
which right. is great, considering the actor that they cast in the role, you know?
Yeah. So Paul's dealing with that, the trauma, and he's carrying that. No one else knows this. So he not only went through this terrible experience like they did, he did three tours in Vietnam, but he also killed
Norman.
Norman, yeah. Stormin' Norman was his nickname. So he's carrying that, and it says a lot about the character, and it helps you understand him more after you've seen the movie. But yeah, that's how it ends up happening, and you don't see that till closer to the end of the movie when you see the whole flashback of what happened.
Right.
You know, Delroy Lindo, I mean, he's just able to just like show that through his facial expressions, you know, his body language, just the hurt that he's going through. I mean, can you imagine like being responsible for the death of your best friend?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He talks how he still sees him in his dreams and like he can't sleep because he's talking to ghosts and, you know, Norman's been hunting him. But when he has that epiphany in the jungle, he's talks to Norman. He's like, it's okay, man. You know, we bloods, man. I don't see how you can't cry at that moment.
It was very emotional. It was a gut punch. And just like, and even the, you know, granted it is Paul's version of that person, right? Like, I think Paul, Paul is going to die. And in that moment, he's having this, vision of Norman standing there. He's like, look, man, we're good. Like, it was an accident. Now, granted, that is what Paul wants to see. And I'm, you know, but it is still that moment of relief that he can get from Norman, in death that he couldn't get in life.
Did you take that as induced by the snake bite from its venom?
Well, he's been shot, but he's been bit.
But at this point, though, I mean, it was early. Like, he gets bit by the snake before the bad guys catch up with him and end up taking him out. So I took it as that snake venom was making him kind of hallucinate.
Probably. And also, a pet peeve of mine, Tom, is when people try to suck the venom out of a snake bite. That's not a thing. That? No, you cannot do that.
Oh,
because you'll swallow the venom. No,
you don't
ever.
Out. You don't, Joe.
You still got it in your mouth, Kevin.
You spit, not swallow. I know you're used to swallowing, but
But also, don't do that.
What do you do? Just let it.
Well, what else are you gonna do at that point?
Yeah.
Look, here's the thing.
You got it. Okay, so here's what you do. You tie a tourniquet around above the bite to stop the flow of the venom.
With one arm.
I'm just telling you.
I will do that, but I'm still going to try and suck it out. Because I'm telling you right now, if even if it's not going to work, I'm still going to try. Because here's the thing.
The adrenaline's like growing and everything. You're just thinking about surviving at that point.
You never know. If I'm in an elevator that starts to fall, I know it probably won't work. But right before it hits the ground, I'm going to try and jump up. Right? Like this.
That's fine.
I know it's not going to. I know physics aren't going to be on my side, but you know what? It's the only game plan I have, and God damn it, I'm doing it.
Hold on. I don't know if I should even say this, but Joe may be right. I just looked up WebMD,
and there's an
article called Don't Suck a Snake Bite, and it says, it's a scene played out in countless cowboy movies and survival shows, a hapless snake bite victim, blah, blah, blah. We know what we're talking about. Quote, the evidence suggested that cutting or sucking and applying a tourniquet or ice does nothing to help the victim.
tourniquet is your best bet.
According to what Kevin just read, tourniquets don't work either. So there you go.
I'm just saying that's the better option than trying to suck the venom out. This has been nature survival with a guy that doesn't live in nature.
Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom.
Yeah, right. So they meet with Jean Reno, who I love that guy. And anytime he gets to play a bad guy, I was like, okay, that's fine. That's
I guess I haven't seen him in a while, and I'm not. I mean, people get
he looks
older.
Old.
I mean, that. Yeah, I mean, that's just
he
what
looks
happens.
Old.
I'm not. But I looked at him and like, this is Leon the professional. Like, I mean,
not anymore. He's the retired professional.
Leon the grandpa. Yeah,
he's,
no.
Yeah, at best, he's semi-pro now.
Yeah. But anyway, I'm just like, I had to look at him for a second though, and I'm like, that's Jean Reno, right? Like, I love that guy. Like, he's been in a lot of movies. He's always great.
He's their go-between. He's gonna facilitate getting the gold out and getting them the money that they deserve. Now they're going into the jungle and they're gonna use these maps, and it's great that they don't use any current, like, they have a satellite phone.
Yeah.
They're using maps, and because what happened was we all know about the mudslides. I mean, it was news. Like, it was a massive deal as the amount of mudslides they had in Vietnam. So the plane had been covered, and just recently through satellite imaging and whatever, they think they found like the tail of this plane kind of where it should have been. So they're going back. The Melvin, I think, has like a metal detector, and they're looking all over. And finally, they start pinging. They're in this one spot, and they start pinging big time. And so we should say that earlier in the movie, Paul's son, has an interaction with this French woman and these two. I don't think the one guy, one guy's American. That one guy is not French. I don't know what he...
Paul Walter Hauser, who was just in that Clint Eastwood movie.
Yeah, he played Richard Jewell, and he was one of the guys who took out Tonya Harding in
Itonya. That's right. That's
Itonya,
right.
And he was also in Black Klansman.
Yeah, those both of those guys were in Black Klansman. I was like, oh, they're in good roles now. I'm happy to see that.
Yeah, but Paul Walter Hauser is awesome. He's a great actor.
Yeah, he played... What was that guy's name?
Richard Jewell.
Richard Jewell, yeah.
If you have not seen Richard Jewell, that movie is phenomenal. Like,
with the exception of the portrayal of the reporter.
Oh, well, okay, whatever. But the,
yeah.
But,
it's a little problematic.
But his performance and Kathy Bates.
Yeah, that's his mom.
Oh,
yeah.
My God. That brought me to tears. I'm not going to spoil it, but this is based on the historical events. Kathy Bates, who plays Richard Jewell's mom, is at a press conference and just, oh, my God. If you don't tear up during that, you have no soul.
He plays the douchebag or the doofus that clubs Nancy Kerrigan and then can't shut up about it.
Yeah, that movie's so good, Itonya.
Itonya's amazing. Yeah. Yeah,
Itonya's really great as well. So,
I was excited to see him pop up here, and I'm glad that Spike Lee's using him. He's great.
So they meet these, and these three folks are is during Vietnam, there were landmines planted all over the jungle. I mean, it's all over the place. So there are, and in real life, there are organizations that go through these areas and try to, because I don't think you can disarm them, but at least get rid of them, because that's a problem. Like, it's a big problem. There was actually a Superman comic book about it.
There was. One of Princess Diana's big charities was trying to clear up landmines. Yeah.
Okay.
What do you do? Throw a bowling ball at it and run away?
I mean, we saw what they did with the sun.
You don't disarm it that way, that's for sure. But, like, I mean, that would be a crazy... I'm not really sure how you would do it, because, like you said, I don't think you can disarm it. You have to let it
maybe
off.
Maybe you just detect it, back off, and throw something at it.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I think
what they normally do is you find somebody that you really don't like.
and then tell them to step there.
Yeah, you just invite them
all
walk
that
walk.
Way.
Just have a little stroll.
I kind of actually wanted to see a scene of them like disarming a landmine, because I hear about it and I know that there's people out there who do it, but it's kind of I want to see it, because like, how do you do it? Because once you step on it,
right,
game over.
Yeah,
you know, it's on. Yeah,
I thought in that scene where David, is that the character's name?
David
steps on the landmine. I thought they were gonna like. Indiana Jones it.
That's what I thought too.
And slide a piece of gold on there and then just leave the gold sitting on there.
I think his weight's just too, like, it needs
I didn't know how much. I don't change my own wipers, so I really don't know much about the mechanics of a landmine. But
but I think it's pretty common knowledge that people know that there's landmines planted all over Vietnam from the war. I mean, mm-hmm. I have to say, I was waiting the entire movie up into this
Same.
Point for someone to step.
Started digging for that gold, I was like, every time they started digging, I was like, son of, don't stop. Like, especially
when they get to that last one.
Whenever anyone would stray from the group, and I was just like, get back, because I'm like, get back with the group. Not because in real life you'd be safer, but in a narrative structure, they're not going to kill all five of them with a landmine
in
an hour left in the movie.
You know what it is, though, Tom? When they find the gold, it is so triumphant.
Yeah.
I was waiting for the other shoe to drop. It's totally it's even too much, a little bit too much, in my opinion. Like, it plays like a little overlong, and the music is really like just so triumphant. And that's why I'm like, Spike Lee wouldn't just have this happy moment, like someone's blown up. So I waited for it the whole time and it never came, but still it's like in the back of your mind, and then
it happens.
Yeah,
it's like
Eddie.
A double head fake. I will also say the scene where they save David from the landmine.
Yeah.
And I just thought the optics of that were fascinating, in that he constructed a scene where, and I don't know how to say this delicately, but he constructed a scene where they used a rope to save a black man. And I just can't help but feel that he had to have known the political ramifications, or not even just.
Or even
just
the imagery.
The imagery of like them doing that. I just thought that was a nice touch.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And I thought the way that the tension is used in that scene, I don't know about y'all, but I was literally on the edge.
Yeah,
totally.
Please do not let him die. Like, whatever you do, please save him, because I can't take another death in this film, because Eddie had just been...
No, we're not. No, we haven't. Oh, you're right. You're right. We did lose Eddie at this point.
Yeah, because
right.
Yeah, Eddie had been blown. I was like, oh my, like, not the son. Like, you know, him and his father rekindle a connection, and to lose him in the fight for finding this goal and finding Norman, it would have been just...
Yeah.
It would have been disastrous.
Sure.
Spike, I mean, I think that's honestly one of Spike Lee's best moments as a filmmaker.
It's a fantastic scene. The tension is there, like you said. I mean,
and it comes at just the right spot, because you had just watched what happened to the other guy. Like, you know that there are real risks in this film, and that they are willing to kill people. We're going to find out they're going to kill off pretty much almost everybody. But like, at this point, you don't know exactly what the stakes are, and it's still been a, you know, for a Spike Lee movie, a relatively lighthearted adventure kind
of
film.
It is like a weird getting the band back together action comedy.
Adventure, like a treasure hunt.
For a lot of it. Yeah. And then this is where it turns. Like, to me, this is where it turns.
Yeah.
It brings in a lot of different films, and a lot, and he openly acknowledges it. I mean, you get Ride of the Valkyries as yeah. they're going up, like, for, you know, which is now synonymous with Apocalypse Now.
Daniel Bryan from the WWE. I agree. You're right.
and
that
and
club
also,
in Vietnam is called Apocalypse Now, with the poster yeah, as yeah, like the right. backdrop.
And you know them looking for gold, and you know, it's very much Treasure of Sierra Madre, where at one point somebody even says, "We don't need no stinking badges."
He does say that, which yeah, I thought was very funny.
Straight yeah. from Treasure of Sierra. So it's like, I mean, he's definitely pulling in these different films, but he's, you know, he's aware of it, and he makes sure that you know that he's aware of it, that he's not thinking he's pulling one over on you, you know.
Yeah, there's tons of references to other films and yeah. war films. He definitely knows what he's doing, and I agree that shift in tone happens, but it feels very organic in the movie. It's not jarring, yeah. it's not uneven. The tone, when it switches and then it's off to the races, and it really fits the narrative. And I mean, from this point, there's the danger, like you said, people are going to die off, but there's a lot of foreshadowing. I wanted to mention
there's a lot of foreshadowing
in the beginning
right.
of the movie. They talk about a real black soldier. I think he was only 17 years old or something, but he died jumping on a grenade. And mm-hmm. I think it was Marvin actually says, or Melvin.
I'd never do that.
Melvin says, he says, I love you guys, but I would never do that. And they're like, no one wants you to. And that's foreshadowing for later in the movie. They say five bloods never die. They multiply. And
yep.
David becomes one of the five bloods. So there's a lot of foreshadowing he sets up, and it's neat to see that play out, especially on a second viewing.
Yeah. So, they get the gold, and while they're getting the gold, Melvin is he has the metal detector, and he finds another, what he thinks to be more gold, and they start digging, and they find an AR-15, or an assault rifle, and they're just like, this has got to be him, this has got to be Norman. So they all start jump down, they all start digging, and they find his body, and they find his dog tags.
We should mention real quick, that's technically why they're there. The reason that
like, yes.
Their cover story for going to get this gold is they're going to bring home his body so that he can be laid to rest and get his, you know, honors and everything.
Right.
So they have all locked this up with the government, that their clearance to be there. And to
they've got
the
their papers.
Back.
They've got yes. everything they legally need to get it done. And this is where we find out what happened. Oh, no, we find out what happened when he gets bitten by the snake.
Yeah, that's later. But you see the body, and like they have this moment, like they're reunited with Norman, and it's a really touching scene with all of them, and it's his skeleton and his dog tags.
Right, and this is where we start arguing about the shares and what they're going to do with the money, and you know, money becomes the root of all evil, and they even say that at one point, and because there's so much money involved in getting this gold out, so they start trekking back. They take a break, and this is where another big fight between the five of them about what to do with the money. And Eddie explains, he's like, I'm broke. Like, I have no money left. This is all I've got. Like, you know, three marriages, gambling debts, blah, blah, blah.
He's the guy that's supposed to have his life together. He's a big,
right. He's the one that financed this whole thing. Like, he's, you know, and as he's walking away, he steps on a landmine and gets blown to smithereens.
head and like shoulders.
He's a head. He's an upper body,
half a torso, yeah,
and half a torso, and no arms, no legs. I mean, the makeup effects are practical. It is next level gore.
You know, they dug a hole. He's in a hole, and then he's got a practical bloodied like stumps for arms and like
squirting
amazing
blood all over the place.
This is how it's done.
It's you know, we talk about practical effects, and as far as war movies go, that wasn't a thing probably until Saving Private Ryan, where they double down on the realism of like what would happen to your face if you took like a shell to the face and things like that. So I'm not saying it's a joy to watch something like that happen to a character you become invested in, but seeing the practicality of them using real effects and real blood, not real blood, but like real movie blood.
Well, if they're going to do it right. If you want to show how much war is hell and people die and it's terrible, like, you're not going to get the full effect of that unless you see it. And that's what these filmmakers do when they show you the truth of the situation, right?
It's like a small enough effect too. Like it's you're not looking at six people, right? You're looking at one person where they can devote time and makeup to making that look as gnarly as possible, and they did. Like, it's not a fun scene to watch.
And it's also something Spike Lee does when he shows you, when he inserts real film footage, he's reminding the audience that this isn't just a movie, this is real life. I think that's what's so powerful about a lot of his stuff, is he implants that, and you're like, wow, these, you know, he's telling you this story, but he's also planting the seeds for why he's telling you the story and what he's trying to show you. And so, yeah, his movies come off as very truthful, and using the practical effects again and not doing de-aging and not doing a bunch of fake CG blood, it makes this movie hard-hitting.
He shows that video, that infamous video. I guess it's a picture. Nobody ever really finishes that video. It's that picture. But
what's that? I don't.
Of the Viet Cong soldier or general shooting that guy in the head.
Oh.
Like, that picture is famous. Like, it's, I think it won a Nobel Prize, or won some prizes for like
a Pulitzer or something.
Yeah, stop at that moment. You never see the end. Like, I've seen that video, and it's real. Like, when the guy hits the ground, there's legit blood squirting out of his head, like out of the head wound. And Spike Lee shows that. He shows that whole thing in its entirety.
Joe, I have to disagree. You have seen that before, because remember we talked about they use that footage in the Monkees movie Head.
But do they show the entire thing?
I don't know if they show the blood, but they show the gunshot and the guy falling. Because talking at the time, like, this is ultimately like a PG film, and they literally showed someone getting killed in it. Like, and I mean, I get that it was all over the news, and at the time, people had probably seen it on their TVs ad infinitum, and so nobody really thought about it through that prism. But watching it now, I'm like, I just watched a snuff film within this movie. Like,
you did, yeah.
So there's the great scene where now David's on the landmine, and they have to devise a plan. They remember, I think, back in Vietnam, they actually saved
someone
the same way. Yeah, they tie a rope around him, and they all get on, like, tug a rope, and they pull him real quick.
Like, you know, the one thing that this film does very well, like any war too, is just showing you how war is hell, you know, sacrifice to be made. You know, war is not just something you jump into just to shoot a gun or anything like that, you know. You know, taking a life is not like stepping on an ant. Like, when you're taking away a human's life, it does something to it. It changes you forever. From my personal experience, I have seen people go and join the military for all the wrong reasons. Like, people are joining because they, like, hey, they, you know, they want to have more money, or they want to be able to buy this Camaro, or they want to just have, like, that prestige of just being in the military. But you have to be ready to sacrifice something, like, whether that's sacrificing a friend, maybe possibly horribly sacrificing a limb, or maybe you're sacrificing your own life, or coming back to America and not being able to readjust to what's going on. Like what happened to Paul. He said that he came back and he was so haunted and traumatized for what he'd been through, he wasn't able to get a connection with his son. And his son is telling him, like, hey, you know, for all the things that you did to me in my childhood, this one-fifth of this goal, this will be enough payment. And, you know, also, there's also the subplot in the death of Paul's wife and his mother. Mm-hmm. So that's another layer that gets peeled back, and Spike handles that very well along as well.
Which is why it should have been a TV show.
It should have been. Should have been. I think you can take anything and make it into a TV show now. You know, well, a lot of these.
Yeah.
Guys, especially since they don't have 23 episodes anymore. It's
when you could take The Hateful Eight and turn it into a 4-hour miniseries. You know, you could do it with this as well.
Like 6 to 8 episodes is the perfect sweet spot,
yeah,
I think.
It's perfect.
I'm going back and rewatching Lost, and it was a great show. Like, I remember how great the show was at the time, but to get through 22, 23 episodes in a season is crazy.
I just started watching Marcella on Netflix.
Yeah.
And it's a British TV show about it doesn't matter, but it's 3 seasons.
Like 4 episodes?
Eight.
Eight, yeah.
And it's like, it's the sweet spot. Like 6 to 8 is your sweet spot. Like that's the way it should be. So when they get all of this done, this is Paul's turn. Like, Paul has always kind of, he's walked that edge of not okay and okay, and having his son there has kind of helped, just kind of steer him in the right direction. But as soon as the, bomb diffuser people realize why they're there, Paul says, we got to kill him. Like, they're going to go back. They're going to tell all these people that we're here and we're going to lose everything. So they kind of take them as their hostages.
Yeah.
And they have to figure out, you know, they're getting back to this meetup point. Otis, they kind of hint that he might be addicted to oxys, but they never go into it. Like, he's got a bad hip or whatever, and he's taking oxy to alleviate some of that pain. And to his, I mean, he's carrying Lord knows how many pounds of, you know, these guys aren't young, and they're carrying this massive amount of weight on their back.
Oh yeah. It would be. And that was when they were hiking, that was before they even found the gold that he was hurting. So yeah.
Right. And on the way back, that, you know, Melvin kind of slips him a couple oxys as well, 'cause he's got them, but never really said anything. And this is where, Paul's son turns on him, kind of. You know, he's not really turning on him, but he's doing the right thing.
Well, yeah, it's not turning, but like, everyone thinks Paul is crazy. Like, clearly Paul is traumatized.
I mean, he is kind of crazy.
It's hard to say. Like, what he's saying is true. Like, these people probably will tell someone.
Yes.
But obviously the ethical correct thing to do is not to kill them or kidnap them. So he's acting crazy and everyone doesn't agree with him. And finally, David is like, we're not going to do this.
Right. You know, and he hits him. Go. He cracks Paul in the back of the head. And he's like, we're just going to, you know, Paul takes his gold and he leaves. He said, you know, well, I guess they get up
not
to the
yet,
top.
Not yet.
They get up to the top where they're going to meet their guide.
They have to explain where Eddie is.
Oh, that's right. And Otis kind of says he broke his ankle. He's going to come back for help. And the guide's like, is that true? And he's like, no. No, it's not. So I took him as like Russian or Eastern European.
Seppo.
Runs away.
He gets loose when they're all tied up at night. He runs away.
Right. Yeah. And he ends up, like, when they get to the meetup point, here comes Seppo with 3, like, cars full of militiamen.
Yeah, he got captured. Like, you know, he was running away trying to get help, and he ran into the wrong people.
Right. And now we've got a firefight. And this is a great, I mean, I don't think Spike Lee doesn't do action sequences very often. I think Inside Man,
yeah.
But
it was good.
That's kind of the only he doesn't. That's not his get. That's not his jam. That dude can direct the out of an action sequence.
This is good.
This is really good. It's really good. The scenes with the Viet Cong at the airplane in the past. This scene here, and then the scene at the end at like the temple. Are fantastic action sequences.
I thought the actors handled themselves and the weapons really well.
Yeah.
You know? Like,
yeah,
these guys,
for sure,
they seemed like soldiers. Clearly, they're not using real ammunition and all that stuff, but just the way they held the guns and the way they were in war, like, I don't know. It really seemed, again, true to me. I don't know what training they might have done, but it was authentic looking.
Yeah, I agree.
Mm-hmm.
So they pretty much win this part, sort of. They push.
Well, Seppo runs away here, right?
Is that right? Seppo runs away and he steps on a landmine and he doesn't get the Eddie treatment where you get a little bit like there's nothing left of Seppo.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. I was gonna say they didn't rescue this guy.
No. He is gone. Like there was nothing left at that point. A massive firefight where they kind of push off this militia for the time being.
David is shot.
David gets shot in the leg, and Paul kind of says, they're coming back. Like, we got to get somewhere where they're going to go. So Otis says, I can call that woman from the beginning of the movie.
Well, also, you got to remember, like, because of all their distrust earlier, Paul's already like, he thinks Otis is working with this woman who's working with Jean Reno, and they think,
right, because they find a gun on Otis. And
yeah.
He's like, you're going to kill us all. Like, that's the plan.
So he's already not trusting. And then he's got this whole, like, you know, his PTSD with the Vietnamese, and he thinks the tour guide Vin is maybe in on it. And so he's just like, I'm out. I can't do this anymore. And
so he takes his share and leaves. So that leaves us with the rest of us. So leaves us with Melvin, Otis, what was the son's name?
David.
And the two. The tour guide. And then the two remaining bomb diffuser people.
Mm.
And the tour guide says there's a temple over the gas can is the gas on the truck that they had been shot. So they're losing gas. There's enough gas to get us to this temple, and we can try. Like, we'll give it a go.
They killed most of the militia, but the head guy got away, and they know he's going to bring reinforcements.
Right.
Especially with all that gold.
Exactly. So they just kind of decide to pack it in, and we're going to go and make a last stand at this place, and we'll see what happens.
After, I guess I have to say real quick, after they went through all that stuff, and the militia comes, and they say, here, you can have this one bar of gold. I was so mad.
Oh, yeah.
What am I supposed to do with this?
It's like when someone's mad at a waitress and they leave a tip of a penny.
Yeah, oh,
it's
what, like, what a jerk
it's,
off.
it's douchier than just not tipping at all.
That scene brought me back to a scene that's in Friday with Ice Cube and Chris Tucker, where Chris Tucker's mom comes to his room and gives him a dollar to go to the store. He's like, hey, hold up. What am I supposed to do with this? She's like, this ain't enough. And then she's like, make it enough.
But man, it's like, you know, they offered because they're not really in the position to make demands, but they're like, okay, we know that Eddie's gone. You can have his share. Like, we'll split this with you guys. Let us go on our way. And he's like, oh, you want to split it? And here's your one gold bar. I was so infuriated. You know, I was happy that they took some of them out, but man,
this next scene to me, whenever we get to the Academy Awards, whatever that's going to look like in 2020, yeah. Mm-hmm. This is the scene that should win him the, I guess, best supporting actor.
Best
you think
actor.
Best actor?
Best actor.
It's such an ensemble piece. It's hard to,
But there's nothing supporting about this performance.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I just mean the entire time this has been a supporting cast, it's at this moment that you could, I agree with you that it should be lead actor, but this is the time where he kind of breaks away from the pact and does this incredible two scene monologue.
It's amazing. This is the, like, the scene that if you're going to remember stuff from this movie, this is one of the takeaways, his performance. Yeah, this kind of like
looking straight down the barrel of the camera, talking to the viewer. It was phenomenal.
This is like how you always remember that Alec Baldwin scene, that Always Be Closing scene.
Oh, from Glengarry Glen
yeah,
Ross.
Like, you know, it's a great film, but you remember that scene. This is like,
Always Be Cobbling, Kevin. Always Be Cobbling.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree. This should. Who know? Like I said, it's a weird year, man. Like, we don't know what is going to happen in 2020 when The Invisible Man is the number one movie for, I don't know, what is it, like 20 weeks in a row, which is just, it sets a record for being the number one movie for the longest
time. Who knows, but he should be nominated. That's all.
Without question. So he does this monologue and he ends up getting bitten by a snake.
Sucks the blood out. Or sucks the venom.
That's a thing, yeah. falls down this hill and gets his leg stuck, and this is the moment where I was like, well, you're screwed. Like, there you've got a snake bite, you've got a broken leg, you're effed in this jungle.
And it goes back and forth, but we should just basically say the militia eventually catches up. They track him.
They did make him dig his own grave.
Yes. Yeah.
And he won't give up the look. He knows where the others are, but he won't give it up. And they're just like, cool. And they unload their weapons into him and kill him.
Ugh. Terrible.
But we should also say
that was brutal, man.
It was brutal.
I never really, like, okay, I'm not saying that I'd be any stronger or tougher in the situation, but when you know you're gonna die, I always think, like, that's weird, the dig your own grave thing, because it's just like, I'm not even gonna do that, just kill me now. Like, what are they going to do? They're making him dig a grave.
I guess you're just trying to buy yourself time.
You're going to go out. I want to go out on my own terms.
You know? Yeah, not digging my grave. Like, I don't know. It's just a little pet peeve type thing, but it's... Yeah.
I agree. But he's got, like, six automatic machine guns pointed at him, and he has lost his weapon at this point.
Yeah, no,
so
it's
you're
whatever.
Just trying. I agree. Like, you're just trying to buy some time and maybe like.
It's like, no, you dig my grave. You have to bury me.
Right. Yeah. I'm not doing it. You're going to kill me anyway.
Yeah, I'm too lazy. I think I would take the bullet even if the if it was just dig this hole.
Tom, we're just asking you to dig a little hole for to store some water in. No.
This is like gardening. I want no part of it.
So at the temple.
So we should say that, like, before we get to that, to the point where the militia has him, is he has a vision of Chadwick Boseman kind of looking up into the sun, and like CD said, this is where he gets his I don't even know what you would call it, like, closure. Yeah. With Norman.
He forgives him, right?
Yes. Norman says it was an accident. I know it was an accident. You know it was an accident. We're good. Like, we're blood. Like, don't worry about it. And then, of course, he gets shot in the chest.
Yes.
This next scene is kind of the reveal that Jean Reno has been in on this the whole time. He shows up with militia, and there's a massive firefight. I keep thinking of the Green Goblin in...
What?
Boondock Saints.
Oh,
where he's talking about the fight, you know, it was a firefight.
I'm like, the Green Goblin? What does that have to do with it?
You know who I'm talking about.
Yes, you're talking about Willem Dafoe, the actor.
Thank you very much. That's who I'm like. Jesus Christ.
Green Goblin.
Yeah. So he pulls up, and of course, they've already, you know, Otis has figured out this plan. He's like, he tells Melvin that you take the top. We got the fat guy is going to try to, like, be our scout. We're going to take him out. We have the idea, like, we have the high ground, sort of, where they're going to be out in the open. We have all this cover, and it's a massive firefight, and it's wonderfully shot. You think there's a moment where, like, oh, they might pull this off. You know, they Jean Reno gets shot pretty quickly.
There's some interesting camera angles, and I think maybe because Spike Lee isn't an action guy, is that maybe he adds a unique perspective to where he's not like, yeah, I do action all the time. He is a great director, and I think he thinks up some pretty inventive angles, and it was a really interesting scene to watch.
Yeah, I agree.
I think sometimes non-action scenes or action scenes filmed by non-action directors can be better because they're more concerned about the narrative, and sometimes a lot of action scenes just kind of fall apart, and just it's a lot of kinetic energy, but you don't really know what's happening. Where I think you know, somebody like Spike Lee is like still, even within that moment, still wants that action scene to have a narrative structure, so you kind of know who's where in relationship to who else, and kind of, you know, who's winning and who's got a gun and who's got bullets left and who does it. Like, I just feel like sometimes they're just better at, like, not letting them turn into just this editing blender mishmash.
Which we see all the time.
And you care about the characters is the other thing. Some people are complaining because the movie's 2.5 hours almost. But the thing is, you've got a lot of backstory. You've got a lot of character development. And by the end of the movie, they've made you care about them, which you couldn't have done. I mean, I'm not saying you couldn't shave a little time off here or there. But, you know, in a short movie, you're not going to care as much about them. So I think it was well-paced for what it was.
What were you going to say, CD?
No, because I was saying, because in the beginning, you know, when they were talking about them being cannon fodder, that's what they would have been if we don't get the backstory for these guys. You know,
sure,
in action
films,
it's better when you care about the characters, because you actually have some real stakes in where the story is going to go. You know, it's better than just seeing this guy's like, oh, this guy's going to get killed. Oh, that guy's going to get killed. Like, no, I want to be like, wow, like, man, you know, I really like that character. Like, why do they have to do him like that? You know, it makes for a better film experience.
And it's also, on the flip side, like, it's not just a happy ending, everyone lives, because that's not realistic.
No, it's not realistic.
Right? Like, there's no way these guys are going to go in here, get the gold, that triumphant music's going to play, they're going to fly them out, they're going to get their shares, be rich and happy, you know, like...
Which you kind of get. but in a different way.
But well, right.
Yeah.
But they it'd be too easy to just do that. And so Spike Lee takes you on a more complex journey, and he's weaving you in and out of this narrative, and the characters are complex. And so, yeah, by the time you get to this final gunfight, you care about these people. And you see Melvin ends up, as was foreshadowed, he does end up jumping out a grenade and saving Otis.
Yes. Otis gets shot, and you think that Otis is, you know, is going to die. He's got Jean Reno kind of has him dead to rights, and he gives the "we don't die, we multiply" line. And then here comes the son and puts a bullet in Jean Reno. And I do like the line where he's like, "I've never fired a gun in my life." And he was like, yeah. "You'll learn."
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you know, I assume we lose Otis, right? Like,
no,
that you no, think that you think that last scene is real. I thought that was like kind of what we got with Paul.
No, Otis is alive. He gets to, he's the only, I mean, David's the new like honorary blood, but yeah, Otis survives.
Okay. I thought, I don't know, the way they filmed that whole last scene where he goes back to Saigon and he meets up with that woman again and sees his daughter and they have this relation, this reconnecting, it felt very dreamlike to me. And even like the way the camera moves at the very end with both of them smiling, and then the like them kind of like being on like a gurney and being pulled in like this unnatural kind of way.
Yeah, but Spike Lee, that's his shot.
Yeah, that's yeah, also like, correct.
He loves that shot. He does it in, I mean, not all of his movies. When did
I think he does it in all of his movies.
Does that Inside Man that?
Oh, he does it way before Inside Man.
Does I'm he? Sure okay, that,
yeah.
I just
yeah,
but,
he did it in Do the Right Thing, Malcolm yeah. X. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah,
yeah. Denzel and Malcolm X is going down the street with the dolly. He does that all the time.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But because he does it in the opening in the club too, with all four of them.
It's not, I was, that's what I was just about to say. I love yeah. that scene of them dancing, but they're like dancing. It's not a dolly. It looks like it, but it's not the same thing.
Really? It looks like they're all moving it like simultaneously through the crowd though.
I don't know. It should have been, because I was just about to say, I thought that was the dolly scene, but the way they moved didn't look as fluid. Like they were, I don't know.
Well, either way.
Yeah. Anyway.
You get the traditional scene.
Yeah.
Or the vintage
But
Spike,
I think,
it,
but I get what you're saying. I think if another director had chosen that moment to use that kind of a shot, it would support your theory more. But because Spike Lee uses, this,
I guess that's a good point. Yeah,
that shot so frequently, I don't think you can read any metaphysical undertones to it. Like
that's
you
fair.
Could.
Absolutely. No, that's just him getting that shot in, and yeah. You expect it. And yeah, I mean, he's the one blood. I'm glad they gave us one of them, because as unrealistic as it would be for them all to die, like if all the bloods died, I just right. think that would have been.
How the hell do they explain that?
What's
like
that?
on the way back, like they're
like
where
to the Americans, like yeah. where are they?
Yeah. Like, where are they?
Yeah. Yeah. Eddie would have been hard enough, but
right. Now you gotta explain where the other ones are.
Yeah.
So we get a breakdown of each person, because when the mine people get involved, they want to share, and then the tour guide wants a share, and so mm-hmm. like Otis is trying to divvy up all of this money, and I do like where Melvin's like, "God damn it, like stop giving away our money."
But the minefield people give it to their organization and dedicate it to their friend
yeah.
who got blown up by a mine.
I guess Melvin's went to a Black Lives Matter movement or an organization. I guess that
Melvin's
was
Melvin's widow gets his share.
Oh, that's right. That's
and
right.
Eddie's share goes to the Black Lives Matter movement.
Okay. And then the tour guide, they don't really. What does he do with it?
He
has it, like he's sitting at a desk, but it.
Yeah, I think maybe he just, yeah, he just has his.
Hookers and blow. Hookers and blow.
Yeah, right.
He started his own business is what I'm guessing.
Oh, an own tour guide business, maybe? That makes sense.
Yeah.
David got his, and.
I would think Norman, maybe, did they send money to Norman's family? Did they ever mention anything about
so
that?
So you see Norman's family with the casket.
I'm guessing they gave him some money.
But I have to believe they got something.
If they brought him home to them and yeah.
There should have been more casket. His two sisters and everything were right there.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, there's only one casket. I feel like there should be probably more.
Right.
But, all right. and that's kind of how this, I mean, you get an ending with Martin Luther King giving the speech. Was it a month later he is shot?
A year later.
This is, and that's kind of how it, yeah, and that's how this one ends, with Martin Luther King giving a very impassionate speech. This is fantastic. This is amazing. Like, this is, we did, CD we did The King of Staten Island before, and watching these, they're two very different movies, but they're both phenomenal. Like, they, this has been two very insanely well done movies. Was this supposed to be to Netflix right away, or was this going to be a theatrical release?
It was going to be a theatrical release.
Was it?
Yeah, because Spike said that he's like, you know, I mean, it's going to close down because of COVID, but, you know, the way to experience this is in the big screen, especially when it comes to the action sequences. That's what he had wanted.
Okay.
He hopes that theaters do again, that he can re-release it back in the theaters.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, I was just looked it up, and it says in February it was announced Netflix would distribute. So yeah, I guess it was made previously. Okay, it's good to know.
And I'm glad somebody was able to get this out, because this is, given where we are in this country right now, this movie needed to be available.
Although, based on the IMDb reviews, it sounds like a good chunk of people didn't make it past the first 4 minutes.
Well, that's their own dumbass fault.
Well,
like, that's
true.
You know.
Yes.
And that's them trying to prove their own, like, little, like, ignorant points. You know, they probably weren't even trying to even give it a chance. They just want to just only see the first 4 minutes and be like, yep, it already did
right.
What I didn't like.
Right.
I'm out.
Sad but true.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's it for this one. Let's go around the table and everybody can say where to find them.
This is Joe. You can follow me on the Twitter at JoeyButts, BUTTS21.
This is Kevin. Follow me on Twitter at KevinRBracket.
And CD, where can everybody find you?
You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, under Black Nerd Magic. You can also find me on Facebook, Kales Davis. And yeah.
Awesome. Thank you for joining us today. I know it's early where you're at, so we appreciate that.
Oh, no problem, man. I mean, if this isn't a good enough reason to get up in the morning, you know, talking about a film, then I don't know what is. So I'd like to thank y'all guys for giving me the opportunity to do that.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Anytime. And you can find me on Twitter at Roger Kubert, or on Facebook at facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. You can find the show online, facebook.com/Real Spoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group. Wherever you're getting your podcast from, be sure and subscribe so you never miss an episode. And, of course, check us out on Patreon at patreon.com/Real Spoilers. So that's it for this one. No idea what we're doing next week. Maybe a return to the world of misbegotten sequels. We shall see. But thanks for tuning in. And until next time, Eddie Mary's Baby Doll.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.